Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2015. Lecture 17, delivered on October 27, 2015. The title of this lecture is Risk and Return.
Today, Risk and Return. This is Chapter 11. We skip a few chapters in the textbook, and we go through several chapters that have to do with the subjects of risk and return and their relationship. And of course, remember I said that in finance, it's not really return that we care about. It's expected return. And that allows me to kind of open it up with a quick little idea that is related to this, which is historical return. Now, historical return is how much you have made if you bought something in the past and you sell it now or at some point after that. So the thing of it is, though, that this is a blunt measure in a way because it's sort of a total return. I'm going to write a formula. It's nothing really hard at all, but it's a total return. It's in finance and actually more generally in business, we want to have things that are comparable to each other. So generally speaking, you would see me annualize a return by one method or another, and I'll get to that in a minute. But a total return on an investment, and this is a really simplistic formula, but it sort of captures the idea, has two pieces to it. There is the dividend that you're going to get somewhere along the way. And I'm going to put at somewhere near time, t plus 1. Time t is now, the total return. Now, and then you divide that by the price that you paid for it at t. T is your start. Now, usually I would use zero here, but the book uses T, so I'm going to try to keep it so that you can see this in relationship to the textbook as well. And that's the dividend yield. In other words, how much did you get in dividends relative to the investment in the stock? So if I bought a stock for $10 and I got a dollar dividend, that'd be a 10% dividend yield. That would be a very generous dividend yield, but there you go. And then there is what you sell it for at T plus 1 divided by what you bought it for at T. That's called your capital gain yield. Capital gain yield. Now, as I had pointed out before, and I've pointed this out several times, some stocks are big dividend payers. There's more weight in your dividend than there is in any gain you're going to get because the company's not putting a lot of money back into the company. It's not reinvesting. So in some cases, the dividend yield would be pretty heavy on an investment. The capital gain yield might not be so wonderful on it. Let me, if I can pull up something, I'll just show you an example of this. This is a pretty simplistic formula. Let me pull up an example here, if I can get this thing fired up here. Google. I can't see anything with the lights off in here. Couldn't they at least SB? I can't see. Seriously? Okay. 1 year. Okay, what I'm showing you here is Starbucks, and I'm going to do exactly a 1 year. That way we naturally would have a dividend yield, or rather a one-year, an annualized return that we would get for the total return. So if I were to look at what the stock price was a year ago, open was $38.55, close $38.27. So the close, let's say we bought it at the, probably at the opening gate. What we'll do is do the opening gate on it at $38.55. So the price would be $38.55 one year ago. You bought it one year ago at $38.55. Now let's say we're going to sell it one year later. At the opening this morning, we sold it. P sub T plus one, one year later, would be running it out here. Well, actually, let me back up here one graph. Okay, Starbucks opened this morning at 63.37. But, oh, let me do it. Yeah, I'll use 63.37 for the 63.37. Now, somewhere along the way, Starbucks paid a dividend of 64 cents. So we've got a dividend there, too. I'm not saying that's a T plus one dividend. It probably happened somewhere along the way. But it's 64 cents per share. So now we can get an exactly a 1 year. You bought it a year ago this morning. You sold it this morning. So it would be approximately a day off maybe, but one way or the other. So my dividend yield would be the 64 cents divided by what I paid for it, the stock, $38.55. That would be the dividend yield. In other words, I put $38.55 in the bank and I got a 64 cent check. That's yeah. And then the capital gain yield would be the 63.37. Oh, I screwed up this formula. That's minus P sub T. Dang. P sub T plus 1 minus P sub T over P sub T. I'm getting ahead of myself here. 63.37 less the 38.55 we paid for it. In other words, the numerator is how much what you made divided by your initial investment, 38.55. Now you're going to see that this stock is heavily weighted toward the capital gain yield. I mean, the dividend is almost like nothing in what would be the calculation. And for God's sake, someone else do this too, so I, in case I make a mistake when I'm trying to pour through this. So I'm going to take the 64 cents divided by $38.55. And that's a 1.66% return. Now, I'm probably going to get a little tiny bit of rounding here. Really? 1.66% return. Actually, that's still not bad, you know. That's better than you get putting your money in a savings account right now, probably. And then the 800-pound gorilla would be the 63.37 minus the 38.55. So you got a gain in dollars of $34.82 divided by 38.55 turns it into a yield, 64.39%. 38%. So there you go. At 1.66 and 64.38. And you get a whop my ass. Oh, you do. 64. Jeez. So your total return on Starbucks for 1 year would be 66.04%. That's a darn good return for a year. Darn good. And as you can see, as I said, that's heavily weighted toward the capital gain yield. Starbucks still plows a lot of its money back into the company's operations, and it's still getting a lot of bang for the buck doing that. See, that money that went, the Starbucks had shareholder money at the bottom at earnings level. It gave a little bit to the shareholders, but it put a lot of it back into the company. And as you can see, the return on that money that it put back into the company made the stock price go up a lot. So Starbucks is still in that mode where it's going to put most of its money back into its own operations because it's got so many very high net present value projects that it can do with its own money. There's a problem with showing you this, though. Well, there are a couple of problems. One is that I did a perfect year's return. If it's more than a year or less than a year, then I'm going to show you another formula this is a simplistic version of a more general formula. More general formula isn't that hard, but it's just, this is sort of the quick, dirty way to get a total return. But if it's not a year, I did a perfect year here. If that had been a year and a half, 2 years, 4 years, you would have gotten not something that's a little bit less reliable for measuring against other things. Here's something more important, though. When you look at this return, it gives you this sense that, oh, man, I've got to get into the stock market, or I've got to buy Starbucks. That's the worst idea in the world for future investment, simply because what happened in the past is not a guarantee of what will happen in the future. As a matter of fact, it could be a very bad sign, because once pros see these kinds of returns, they're going to be attacking the stock, buying it, driving up its price to the point where by the time you grab an investment like this, you might not get any kind of a return at all because it's already been absorbed by an efficient market. Think about it this way. Madam, have you ever bought a lottery ticket? You have. I have too. Get those six numbers, you know, and then I watch, you know, the balls and they pull one. 3, 18, 27, and they go through them. And of course, I'm thinking to myself, nope, nope, nada. But then I'm thinking, oh, man, I could have chosen those numbers. Darn it, I should have. I could have chosen them. Next time, I'll choose the right. That's the flaw in thinking that people do when they buy stocks, is they think, oh, I'll do it next time because now I can see the return. Well, that doesn't do a thing for you for the future. That's like you've walked down a field. Everything's safe, even though I can't see a thing in front of me. Well, that doesn't mean that the next step isn't off a cliff. Ah! Okay? Keep that in mind. Don't let these kinds of incredible numbers do anything to you. This is what these financial gurus on TV do and on the radio. Well, look at the return on this. So what? That's, you're showing me history, and that's nothing about what is going to happen. You're teasing me with the past, and the past is not a good guide. As a matter of fact, like I said, that could actually be a very bad guide, because that's the kind of thing that brings all of the boys to the yard. There's the milkshake, and they'll have all the milkshakes drunk by the time you get there, and you know what you're going to get? You're going to get the dog pee on the tree. Oh, there's a damn good analogy for you. Anyway, look, there's a more general formula that there are two ways that you can approach returns over a longer period of time. One thing is that you can do year by year, add them up and divide by the number of years of a return. Year by year, get the year by year returns and then add them up and divide by the number of years. That's called an arithmetic average. The book shows you that quite a bit. Interestingly, now I've gone through the textbook three times and I can't find it, but in the test, they ask you to find a geometric average. A geometric average. And that's a different animal, but I can't find in the book. They show you the formula, one of the ways of doing geometric averages, but they don't call it a geometric average in the book. I'm going to show you what I mean by a geometric average. It's a very generalized way of annualizing returns. Let me take you on a trip here. Let's take Starbucks and let's take it out for a two-year ride. Now, 2 years ago, let's see if I can get this nailed to exactly 2 years ago. The price was $40.32. Okay? Price was $40.32 2 years ago. Now, all I'm doing here is a capital gain yield. I'm doing just a capital gain yield. Now, the price 2 years out was what we just saw on the opening this morning, $63.37. Now, there are two ways that I could approach finding the yield on it. Actually, there are three ways, but I'm not going to show you. Well, third way, the book's got it, but it's not really that normal for this kind of work. One way would be to just simply take 63.37 minus 40.32 over 40.32. That's a two-year capital gain. And then you just divide it by two. Well, let me do that. The two-year capital to get to 1 year. Seriously? I would do 63.37 minus 40.32 and then divide that result by 40.32. You bought it 2 years ago. So that would be a two-year capital gain of $57.17%. And then to get to 1 year, I would just divide that by two or multiply it by 1/2. Just divide that by two. Would be 28.58%. That's called an arithmetic average return. 1 year arithmetic average return. And it's actually a quick, dirty, I mean, I'll even do that one, just to get a quick annual return. Like I said, we kind of like to have everything annual so that we can compare different companies and all that. That's the arithmetic average. And you'll get a couple of test questions. They're really no-brainers at all. Just add them up, divide by the number of years or whatever. Now, there's another way. It's more sophisticated and it's more accurate. It's more correct. It falls under the category of geometric return. What I would do with that one is I would take, this is called the annualized, more generally, it's called the annualized return. In this case, I'd take 63.32, what you sold it for, divided by 40.32, and I would raise it to the 1/2 power and then subtract 1. That's a much more generalized way of doing it. And it takes into account compounding, which arithmetic average doesn't. It should come out to be a little lower than the arithmetic way of doing it. Now, you just take it to the 1 over the number of years. Even if you have parts of years, it's really easy. Like if I held it for 655 days, I just take 650, I would just raise it to, well, I'll show you that in a minute. Let me do this first here. Wait. Seriously? Does this calculator suck? Yes, it does. It just turned off on me. What the? Okay. I'm going to take 63.37 divided by 40.32. 32, and I'm going to raise that whole thing to the 1/2 power, which is a square root, actually. And then don't forget to subtract 1. Don't ever forget to subtract 1. And I would find that the annualized rate of return was 25.37%. That's the annualized way of doing it. It's more general, more sophisticated, and it gives us a more accurate picture as well. Notice something interesting, though. It really, in a lot of cases, when you look at stocks and bonds and investments, your rate of return is going to be highly dependent on your time frame for analysis. Do you see that when I looked at the Starbucks as a one-year investment from 1 year past to now, well, that thing was just, geez-zooey. The capital gain part of it was 64.38%. What a great investment. But if I had looked at that as a two-year hold, well, the capital gain yield is 25.37%. Look at it at different times. So a lot of times you might get someone trying to sell you on a stock, and they'll show you this incredible capital gain yield on it. The first thing you want to know is, what was the holding period that you used for this? You'd be surprised at how many times I've seen these people hawking some stock brokers. They'll find the lowest place possible that the stock could start at, and then they'll go from there to the current price, which is up here. And they'll say, look at this incredible yield on this stock. Well, if they had chosen a place farther back or farther forward, they would have found that that price might have been way up here, even possibly even higher than the current price, and so the yield would have been commensurately lower. So keep an eye on that when you're thinking about investments, that it really depends on your time frame, what the capital gain is going to look like. Generally speaking, it's a lot better to ask, what's a long-term yield? Go out, go long, because buy and hold is the best strategy there is anyway. Say, all right, is this a long-haul investment? Is this a great investment? Another thing that you might want to look at is find the high point in the past and compare it to the present price. Find the low point in the past and compare it to the present. Look at them and see the range of yields that are going to come out of this stock. A lot of different things. It doesn't boil down to a single number. It never does, unfortunately. And that's one of the problems we have now. We try to break complex data down to simplistic things for the average person to see, and that kind of loses it. I could easily say Starbucks capital gain yield is 34%. Isn't that all awesome? Well, actually, that's awesome if you had bought it a year ago and sold it today. But if you bought it 2 years ago and sold it today, that capital gain yield would have been only 25%. You might find that over a period of time, there are a lot of different things that it could be. Anyhow, something that I wanted to bring up here, I wrote down a note for myself to remind you. Just one more emphasis. This is the past. What we really, really care about is the future, because the past is gone. You're never going to buy the stock at the price it was. You're going to buy the stock at the price it is or will be in a few seconds. So always, always keep historical data in check. Yeah, it could tell us about the performance of a company. If they've got their stock price has been doing good over a period of time, that's not about the stock price. That's about the management. That's about the market. That's about the world around that stock. That's about the world inside of that stock. So the stock price is just sort of like the final artifact of things going on inside. And then you ask yourself the question, are those things still going on inside? I'm looking at, you. You are a muscular, handsome stud. I mean, my God, you're built like a brick shit, in a manly sort of way. Now, great, great, man. yeah, you are the king. 40 years from now, you won't be. You'll have a big pot belly. You'll be bald. I know, right? And you'll be bald. You will not have manscaped in 20 years. And you won't be a thing like you are now. Unless you watched a movie like Rocky. And then you realize, I got to get back in shape. I got to start like this. And drinking 5 raw eggs in the morning before I run. I watched that movie and I tried the 5 raw eggs. I mean, I did it. I actually did it. You want to talk about a debris field? Anyway. So did that teach me a lesson? Hell no. I tried it again the next morning. No better. My mother started bitching about the yellow on, you know, the yellow kitchen. I said it was sunshiny. Anyway, look, what I'm trying to get at here is that you look for consistency of performance in the stock price. Underlying that is consistency in performance of the management and consistency in performance of the economy and all of those other factors that drive the stock price. What was good in your youth? Drinking, carousing, staying up all night. Someone saying, here, man, try this, and you saying, okay. You trying to impress your friends by saying something like, watch this, which actually is last words for many young men. But, you see, the thing of it is that did you modify? Did you adapt? Did you keep growing in a changing environment? That fundamental analysis. I can't emphasize that enough in a class like this. Because we talk about all these technicals, all this math, all the time. Yeah, the math is important. As you see, I beat the hell out of you in the online stuff. But when it gets down to the writing it out and thinking, that goes beyond math, miles beyond math. Okay, enough of that bitching about that. But I did bring up something important here. Risk and return. Risk is the other thing. And I showed you, we have some metrics of risk that are very useful. But I brought up a mighty important concept a while back in the course, that there are actually two kinds of risk in any investment. There are two kinds of risk in any investment. In fact, you can push that concept into life itself. The two dimensions of risk are unsystematic . Sometimes we call that diversifiable risk . And then there is systematic risk . Now the systematic, the root word here is system . This is called non-diversifiable. This is risk. Unsystematic risk is risk that is peculiar to the investment itself. If you're investing in a common stock of a corporation, this would be the kind of risk that is inherent in this company, in its buildings, its factories, and its managers, those kinds of things that don't affect other companies. They're inside of that company. Those kinds of things, those kinds of risks that create volatility in stock price would be canceled out by buying other stocks, because those risks would not be perfectly correlated. This company sucked today, this company did well today in its factory. They kind of smooth each other out. And the more stocks you buy, the more of that unsystematic risk goes away. That's why we call it diversifiable. You can get rid of it by diversifying your portfolio. You should never expect a reward. Well, I took a risk on this stock. Well, good for you, you dumbass. You don't deserve a reward for that, because you could have gotten rid of it. And that's, if you think about it in life itself, well, I took some real risks. Well, you didn't have to take that risk. Yeah, I drove without my seatbelt on. I'm a wild guy. Well, good for you. You could have put your seatbelt on, then you wouldn't have had that risk. No one's going to pay you for being a wild and crazy guy that way. That's the idea, is that this is not a risk that gets rewarded by stock markets. Yeah, I invested in one stock and I made $1 million. Good for you. There were about 1 million other people who did something stupid like that, and they got their asses beaten. And so, but they're not on TV. Yeah, I got my ass beaten. No, you only hear about the unusual one who wins at that game. This is this kind of bias. It's actually written about in academic literature. Even in law enforcement, this is understood. When you're driving down the highway, yeah, everyone's driving faster than me, so I better break the speed limit too. No, you see the people going faster than you. The people who are going at the same speed as you, obeying the speed limit, you'll never see them on the highway. So you get this bias toward higher risk behavior. Don't fall for that, especially in stock pricing, because it's the way to ruin. And I'll show you, as a matter of fact, let me point out something, but let me talk about systematic, or sometimes it has to do with the system, the world, the globe. It doesn't even have to do with the industry itself. It has to do with the economy, with the forces that pull and drag each and every business around. Now, and those are the ones that you can expect a reward for. But you have to shake out this diversifiable risk. It is a lot of noise in the overall risk signal. Now, the textbook actually does a neat thing, and I've got some of these myself. I couldn't find them for today's lecture. It shows the total risk of a common stock, measured by the volatility, the up and down of the stock market. And then it shows how much of that risk is unsystematic and how much is systematic. I mean, you'll see that even with companies like Google, the unsystematic portion of the risk, the part of the risk that you won't get rewarded for at all, you shouldn't expect it, is a large component of Google's overall stock price volatility. Microsoft has less, but it still has, I think maybe about half of its total volatility is volatility that you can get rid of by simply having it in a diversified portfolio. And so even big companies are carrying tons of unsystematic risk. Smaller companies, it's even stronger. But there's the next point that I need to get to, is how is risk related to size of a company and all this? And for this, I'm not sure how to pursue it. Madam, have you ever had a fly annoy you? It's all over the place. You're trying to smack it. Miss me, asshole. Okay. Okay, that's I mean, it's just all over the place. Relative to its size, it's just going boing, boing, boing. Now, have you ever had a pterodactyl annoying you? Really? Yeah. A dragon? What? You know, you're telling me Game of Thrones is... I watch it for the dragon. Well, when the dragon comes around, it's not going, it's going, not as much volatility. Now, here's the other thing. You actually finally smack the fly. Smack. It goes way over there. Now, that pterodactyl, you wah, flap, pam. Okay? It's probably just move like that. Yeah. Okay? You understand my analogy? Yep, he's high. What I'm trying to point out is that small things have tend to have much more volatility. They'll swing up and down. Both systematic and unsystematic risk are going to be more significant when something is small because it is pulled around and thrown more by the forces around it. Large things are not like that. During the recession, the Great Recession, in my own business, I create and sell landscape photographs. They're beautiful, but the thing is that during that recession, I mean, the world's economy was like unbelievably bad. And my tiny, tiny little company was essentially the basement floor of a multi-story crap house. So I was just being ruined, destroyed by those vast forces far beyond me. You had companies much far, far larger. Yeah, they were hurt, but the damage was not nearly as great, and they swung more slowly in the wind of the bad times that were happening. My cash flow position changed literally by over 100%, went negative, blood red negative, and then it came back during the first year after the recession was over. People pulled their money out, and they were buying again. Cash flow went back up black nicely. So my cash flow was, and of course, if I had publicly traded stock, that would have been reflected brutally in the stock price. But you had companies like Target or Walmart. Yeah, their prices swung, but they were so strong, so large, that it really didn't hurt them nearly as much. That's the next point that I want to show you, is to show you certain stock indices. Now, I'm going to do three here. And make sure you know these, because I bring them up. I might even bring them up on a written exam, on a test. Not the technical as much as understanding. The 800-pound gorilla of 30 massive industrial publicly traded companies is the Dow Jones Industrials, the 30. It is an index that measures the stock price of those 30 companies as a portfolio. The index assumes that the dividends that are paid are reinvested in the stock, so that you're seeing just a pure yield moving through time with the Dow. Now, Dow has some other indices too. But it's like this would be the largest companies in the world, or at least nearly, many of them. And it's not the same 30 companies through time. The Dow Jones company will sometimes kick a company out and put another company in if the world has changed enough. Like 50 years ago, industrials were everything. In our era, industrials are still hugely important, but so are these very large high technology companies. So the Dow kind of reaches across stock markets, brings together what is the greatest of our time, and 30 of them. You would expect this portfolio to have a low beta. Okay? Now, the next one that I'm going to bring up before I show you the graph is the S&P 500. Standard & Poor's puts together an index of its own. This one takes 500 of the largest companies, very well-heeled companies, and brings them together as an index, like you have that portfolio. As a matter of fact, you can actually buy a kind of stock called an ETF that is the S&P 500. So if you wanted to own those 500 stocks, you could in a way. Well, actually, it would track the S&P 500. It would be the S&P 500. This would obviously be also a riskier portfolio because it does have more adventuresome companies. They're big, but they are playas in the world. And again, it assumes that dividends are reinvested in the portfolio, so you get a pure kind of return moving through time. Now, the last one that I'll bring up is, and I think I've said this one at least before, is the NASDAQ. The NASDAQ is a compilation of tons of companies. They are small cap. In other words, they're not the biggies. these, although there are huge companies in the NASDAQ. Some companies just decided never to go with the New York Stock Exchange or something like that. They just stayed with the NASDAQ. So it's sort of like a measure of the lower base of the economy with flex and pick and picks from big companies in it. Obviously a riskier portfolio. Okay? It's a beta would be higher. So with that in mind, let me take you over to this. This is Fred, the Federal Reserve's graphing. This is such a great thing, but as I told you before, you've got to be sure, cross-check, because the Federal Reserve has incentives in some narrow areas to not particularly represent the past as it actually happened. But here, this is just from 2009 to about the present. About, I think, 6 years I did. Notice the volatility. These are percent changes from month to month. These aren't levels. The levels, I mean, the levels would just be all giant. The graph would have a ridiculous vertical axis. But these are percent changes from month to month. Now, as you can see, of course, the green one is up and down more strongly. There's more volatility in it. You see it? It just swings more. Notice that the swings are all correlated. They are all tracking essentially a market portfolio. And what we're seeing there is, see, in the case of, interestingly enough, maybe I know a number of analysts who consider the S&P 500 to be a very good approximation of the market portfolio because it comprises so much of the total market cap of the economy. So in those 500 giant companies. So in a way, you could kind of look at everything with the S&P 500 as almost like the beta 1, beta equals 1. Now you see how the NASDAQ swings more, magnified events. Now these aren't company events. These aren't industry events. These are worldwide or at least national economic forces. And the NASDAQ is magnified. The Dow Jones 30 Industrials is suppressed, is demagnified. So you're almost like seeing a beta, I don't know, that might be a beta of about 1.3, 1.4. And then down there, the Dow, that might be a beta of 0.7. And then there, the one that's the S&P 500, the blue one, that's around a beta of 1. So you're actually kind of seeing over time, over a long period of time, the percent changes in portfolios of different betas, of different expected reward risk levels in this graph. Now, there are other indices that you can look at, too. Some of the Wilshires are popular. Now, one thing I would warn you, the Wilshire indices are a little weird because a good index would measure each stock in the portfolio would be in the portfolio, its weight would be its contribution as far as market cap to the entire portfolio. So in other words, if company A is 30% of the whole portfolio's size in the market, then that would be 30% of the size of the portfolio's total assets. The Wilshires don't do that. They just take the arithmetic average. So they're a little bit suspicious that way, but they're actually still popular. But there are a lot of different indices that you can try out. S&P has a 100, a 500. Dow has different indices. The most popular is the Wilshire. Now, there are bond indices, too. Let me see if I can find one real quick to show you one more thing. Okay, add a data series. I'm going to search corporate bond. AAA bond yield. I don't know. I'll just do that. That one, no, that one's not going to work. Okay, try seasoned corporate bond price. Whoops, price. All right, on high. Munis, real bonds. I'm not going to find anything really fast here. High grade yield. Oh, well, I might as well do that one. Yeah. That one's, I don't think I'm going to, that one's not going to work out too well. I don't know. I'm going to forget about that. I got something else to show you here real quick. One problem you have is that in a good economy, stocks go up. In a bad economy, they generally tend to go down. Always be careful about what you are looking at in terms of adjustment. Most of the time, the data you see will be nominal data. Nominal data. In other words, it is not correcting for the erosion of purchasing power from inflation. It's just what you see with your eyes when you look at a price. The price is going up. But the real question would be, how much is it going up relative to inflation? In other words, you would have to look at the real to get the full picture. So I can say, well, the Starbucks two-year yield was annualized was 28.58%. But how much of that was just inflation? And so when you are doing these kinds of numbers, you might want to look at what inflation is doing. In other words, make an adjustment. And here's why that might be important to do. As I told you, I was writing starting about 2006, 2005, I was warning that something was going wrong with our economy. The American economy was in trouble. And it didn't look like it to a lot of people. Well, the growth rate of the economy is 3%. Everything looks good. Stock markets are going up. But there were other numbers that were telling another story. One that was really worrying me was that investment had collapsed. Capital investment in American companies had collapsed. It was only about a third in the first 5, 6, 7 years of the 21st century. It was only a third of what it had been in the 1990s. That's a very bad sign. But then another measure. I decided I was curious about something. So what I did was I took the returns, annualized returns, to the big three, the Dow, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ. They were all positive annualized returns from the beginning of 2002 to 2006. I said, what happens if we adjust out inflation? Look at the real returns. This is what I got. I published this in 2006. Taking out inflation. Notice, by the way, the effect of beta. Dow, not as damaged. S&P, more damage. NASDAQ, huge damage. You were actually losing money in purchasing power to the extent that, on an annualized basis, if you had invested in a well-diversified portfolio of Dow stocks, you would have lost about 0.5% a year of your $100. If you had put your money into the S&P 500, in real terms, every year you would have lost about 1.5% of your money in purchasing power. If you had been a risk taker and you had bought the NASDAQ portfolio, again, a well-diversified portfolio, in real terms, you would have been losing at the rate of about 4% a year over those first years of the 21st century. That was right there an unbelievably obvious sign that something was going seriously wrong.
were financial analysts there on TV or in the government or even in the think tanks that were opposed to the Bush administration saying anything about this? No, because everyone looks at the nominal prices, the prices right there on the screens, instead of taking that extra step to adjust out the effect of inflation. If you do that, you can see a much different picture of what the world looks like, and you'll be one leg ahead of most of the analysts out there. Because they're going to look at the price from day to day. They're never going to tell you, well, let's adjust inflation out and see what you really earned on this investment. Truth of the matter is, we have sector inflation going crazy right now. But it's not general inflation. Commodity prices are beginning to collapse. Now, the last part of this lecture. Finance has behind it. What I'm teaching you here, if you were stupid enough to go on for a PhD in finance at a good high-powered college, you would find out that what we do in finance is very similar to physics. It's the same equations, the same unbelievably complicated math. It's so complicated now that we can't even do the math. We have to have computers price the options because of the stochastic partial differential equation systems and all that kind of good stuff. But here's the deal. There are underlying principles of physics that are driving what happens in stock markets. It's just the same thing. I was making that joke about the blah, 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 but it's actually, that's a principle of physics called Brownian motion. That random motion of things that kind of pushed around by random forces. It's one of the things that we do know about stock markets is that they do have a positive bias. You buy a diversified portfolio, good diversified portfolio, and you hold it for a very long period of time, it will grow. It might be down if you look at it at one time. It might be up as you look at it another time. It might be WTF if you look at it another time. But over a long period of time, it has a positive bias. It's called a submartingale process. We even know some things about that positive bias. One of the things we can know, based on some important parameters, like constants of the universe as they apply to finance, we could even tell you what the annualized rate of return would be on a portfolio held over a very long period of time. One of those parameters, it's like a constant of the universe, like the speed of light, pi, Rydberg's constant, those E, those kinds of constants. It's called Tobin's Q. It drives the number that will be the long-term annualized rate of return. Tobin's Q, 1950, 1960, 1970, you bought and held over a long period of time that parameter Tobin's Q would give you a return over a long period of time of maybe about 7% annualized. Over a period of 40-year buy and hold, you would have a damn nice portfolio by the time you retired. Then, in the later 1990s, the data and the theory were looking at something kind of troubling. Tobin's Q was going to shift. It was going to slip. And when it slipped, that would mean that the next generation that bought and held would have a lower long-term return. It slipped to a point where it looked like the long buy and hold annualized rate of return was going to come out about 5%. Not 7%, 5%. Now understand what that means. Over a very long period of time, from the 1950s to the current era, real wages have not gone up hardly at all. In real purchasing power, you will earn about what your grandparents, possibly your great-grandparents, earned. So it was important for this portfolio to have this nice positive bias, 7%. Because that gave you something more than just those crap wages that weren't getting any better over time. But then when Tobin's Q slipped, and it did slip, that meant that you would not get as much as previous generations got. The upshot? Tobin's Q is shifting again. What are you looking at? Oh, the stock market's doing great, yeah. Well, by the time you get out there and you start investing, it might be the long buy and hold, the long-term buy and hold might be 3 to 4%. In other words, your wages are not going to go up in real purchasing power over your lifetimes. We see no reason to believe that it's going to get any better than it has over the past three generations. And your portfolio of investments is not going to be as good as it was for your parents, whose wasn't as good as it was for their parents. That's a dark future in front of you. So go out there and be happy. That's all I have for you. Go home.